Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. Thanks for joining us today. I hope you're having a great day. You know, our mission here at Open Your Eyes is to help us all open our eyes a bit more to the possibilities and realities all around us. And each week, we try to bring messages that will help you in real and practical ways to live a happier life. So today, wherever you are as you listen to this podcast, I hope you get a new perspective of how you can think and live better. And if this podcast inspires you a bit, please share it with a friend. It just may be what they need in their life today. Let's get started, shall we? Today, I'd like to talk about how to be in the top 1% this year. When people talk about being in the top 1%, they usually frame it as a comparison against other people, meaning others have more talent, more drive, more intelligence, more hustle, or more wealth. But what if it wasn't about wealth? What if being in the top 1% was about being in the top 1% of what it is that you value? Maybe it's the top 1% of those who are satisfied with their life. Maybe the top 1% is reserved for those who enjoy their work or their life or their efforts. Regardless, here's the simple truth. The door is open. You are invited to step through to be in the top 1% club. It's your choice, but the rewards of being in the top 1% are pretty incredible. Now, if being in the top 1% was about income, if you earn $790,000 per year, you'd be in the top 1% of income earners in the United States. In California, you'd need to earn $1 million to be in the top 1%. But all of that changes if you want to be in the top 1% in the world. To be in that club, you only need to earn $160,000 per year. In terms of net worth, you'd have to have a net worth of about $900,000. So many of you on this call are in the top 1% in the world. And you may not know this, but yes, 99% of the world earns less money than you. And that means you've done some right things and you are indeed fortunate. Recently, the World Population Review finished their world happiness score for people living in every country around the world. The least happy country was Afghanistan, with a score of 1.72 out of 10. In Afghanistan, with the return of the Taliban, women no longer have access to education. If you're giving birth in Afghanistan, you don't have access to medical facilities or ultrasounds or surgical procedures most of the time. If you have a C-section, you must travel to Kabul or another large city, most for a six-hour or more drive. Many women don't survive. With little sense of security, it's no wonder that the people surveyed rate their life there as unhappy. The other countries at the bottom of the list were Lebanon, Sierra Leone, and the CR Congo. Sitting on the top of the list, the top 1% of the happiest countries in the world was Finland. Why? Well, people feel like they're part of a community and they have trust in each other. They felt strongly that they were free to make their own choices. And for older adults, they felt they were cared for. Interestingly, the U.S. was way down the list after Israel and Canada and Slovenia and a number of others at number 22. So as a whole, Americans are not in the top 1%. What would it take to be in the top 1%? Well, the answer to that question could reveal a lot of very useful information. Well, what about you? Are you in the top 1% in terms of your satisfaction with life? Are you in the top 1% in your business? Are you there with your savings? If not, then what is the answer to why are you not in the top 1%? In terms of business, would you like to be in the top 1%? Here's what I've learned. The separation between the other 99 and the top 1% does not happen during moments of inspiration. It happens during ordinary days, ordinary meetings, ordinary decisions, when no one is watching and no one is applauding. The top 1% aims for reliability, and most people wait for motivation. But the top 1% designs their life, so motivation is optional. Their life is a series of purposeful, repeated actions that lead them to the top 1%. Most people believe excellence is something you rise to. The top 1% believes excellence is something you prepare for so thoroughly that it feels almost uneventful when it arrives. Now, across medicine and engineering and leadership, law, education, and business, the same pattern seems to show up again and again. The people who end up in the top tier are not necessarily more gifted. They're more deliberate. They build systems where others rely on memory or initiative. They choose consistency where others chase intensity. They think earlier, prepare longer, and follow through when it would be easy to slack off. Now, that pattern is visible in the work of Dr. Gawande, whose research into surgical error revealed an uncomfortable reality. Highly trained professionals, people at the absolute top of their field, were still making preventable mistakes. Not because they were careless or incompetent, but because complexity overwhelms human attention. And Gawande found that aviation and construction had already solved this problem. They didn't trust expertise alone. They trusted checklists, simple standard steps that removed the burden of memory and ego. So when he helped introduce a basic surgical checklist in hospitals around the world, the resistance was immediate. Surgeons felt insulted. They believed their training made such tools unnecessary. Yet when the checklist was used consistently, complications and deaths dropped dramatically. The insight was not about intelligence, it was about humility. The top 1% does not assume they will rise to the occasion. They assume they are human and they design accordingly. You know, the same humility shows up in how the top 1% builds credibility. Marcus Ranham, one of the foundational thinkers in modern cybersecurity, didn't rise in his career because the field was glamorous. In fact, he entered it when almost no one cared. Security then was ignored and underfunded. Ranham didn't wait for recognition. He wrote clearly, answered questions patiently, and shared his thinking openly. He showed up early, long before the market validated his work. And when cybersecurity finally became unavoidable, when breaches and threats and vulnerabilities couldn't be ignored, Ranham was already trusted. He didn't need to announce his expertise. He'd been accumulating it quietly for years. The top 1% often build leverage and relationships long before opportunity arrives. They invest in usefulness when there really isn't an audience yet. The same discipline shows up in leadership, particularly in people who never sought the spotlight. Frances Hasselbein is one such example. As CEO of the Girl Scouts of the USA, during a period of major social and organizational change, she transformed a struggling institution into one of the most trusted nonprofit organizations in the country. She didn't do it with charisma or dramatic reform. She did it with clarity and respect and relentless follow-through. She was known for something deceptively simple. She listened deeply, wrote things down, and did exactly what she said she would do. She treated people with dignity. She prepared meticulously for meetings. She focused on mission more than ego. And over time, her reliability created extraordinary trust. Leaders across sectors, from the military to business to education, sought her counsel not because she demanded authority, but because she earned it. Another example comes from manufacturing, a field rarely associated with progressive leadership. Ken Iverson, the longtime CEO of Nucor Steel, built one of the most successful steel companies in America by rejecting nearly every traditional management assumption. He eliminated executive perks, flattened hierarchy, and tied compensation directly to performance. And what truly set him apart was his consistency. The rules applied to everyone all the time. As a result, employees trusted the system because it never changed. And he believed that predictability was not rigidity, but respect. People could take risks because the environment was fair. And over the decades, this resulted in productivity and loyalty and innovation. The top 1% understands that culture is not what you say, it's what you do and what people can count on. Now, the same principle appears in education. Take, for example, the work of Roland Fryer, an economist who studied why schools dramatically outperform others despite serving similar populations. And what he found was not inspirational speeches or extraordinary teachers, but consistency in execution. High-performing schools implemented small, evidence-based practices, more instructional time, frequent feedback, clear expectations. There was no single miracle solution. There was discipline. And his research showed that when good practices are done consistently, outcomes change. The top 1% does not look for magic. It looks for leverage and does things consistently. What about you in your business? Could you do things more consistently, prepare more relentlessly in advance, and treat everyone on your team with the same standards? These would be good things for you to rise to the top 1% in your business. The top 1% replaces motivation with design. They build systems that make the right behavior easier and the wrong behavior harder. Being in the top 1% rarely feels dramatic. It feels structured. It feels calm. It feels almost boring. For you, it may mean returning that call quickly or following through on that promise, thinking ahead of the meeting or documenting the process, and doing the small things correctly every time. And over weeks and months, those behaviors compound into something powerful. Becoming part of the top 1% doesn't require reinvention, it requires intention. Choose a few behaviors that matter and design your environment to support them. On this topic, one author wrote, "To be in the top 1%, pick one skill and train it daily. Not 10 skills, not 5, but one. Most people scatter themselves and wonder why they're not getting anything worthwhile done. Top people go deep before they go wide. Hone your leverage. When I decided to get better at writing," he said, "I didn't tell myself I'm going to be a writer. I just committed to writing daily. And my first few attempts were awful, but I didn't care how good it should be. I just persisted. And I'm still learning. But now I'm a better writer than I ever used to be." Patrick Collison is best known today as the co-founder and CEO of Stripe, the global payments company that is valued at tens of billions of dollars. But his rise to the top in technology wasn't driven by luck or marketing savvy. It came from choosing one skill early and deliberately practicing it better than most anyone else: writing great software. Clean, efficient, scalable, and elegant. Patrick grew up in Ireland and started coding when he was young. And early on, he tried many things. But at a certain point, he made an almost silent decision. Instead of spreading himself thin across languages and contests or trends, he committed to mastering systems-level programming and algorithmic problem-solving at an unusually deep level. And he did it daily. While others treated coding as a hobby or a means to grade in school, Collison treated it like a craft. The daily commitment to deep technical work gave him an edge, and when he and his brother started Stripe in 2010, they built a payments platform that was radically simpler than anything else in the market. It wasn't flashy. It was engineering elegance, and developers liked Stripe because it worked. It worked reliably. It was easy to understand, and over the next decade, Stripe grew from a few computers in a co-working space to powering payments for millions of businesses around the world. It's interesting, isn't it, that you and I could probably cite dozens of stories of people who have arrived in the top 1% of their craft and have done so with this same formula, becoming very good at what's most important. So in your business, maybe the person who can add names to their sales list and set appointments is the one who arrives at the top 1%. So what if you focused on this skill this year, becoming in the top 1% in that skill? Would your business prosper? Yes. This is a powerful principle. You don't have to be at the top of 1% of everything, only in the top 1% of the one or two things that really matter. If you work at it daily, even for a short time, you'll see that you're getting ahead of 99% of everyone who doesn't. Consistency beats intensity. You've heard that a million times, I know, but have you tried it? Something changes after a month or two of consistency, something that all of a sudden you see, and the difficult things seem doable. Now, here's something else that I've learned: that the top 1% make the default performance at a much higher level than others. I used to run with a running group, and each of the people who would show up in the morning had a different level of pace and capacity. I was very much middle of the road. And I used to ask myself, how do these other guys, some who are the same age as me, run at such a higher level? Then I soon learned why. Their training schedule, that was the default schedule for them, the everyday run, was equal to my bigger and longer runs. My default was so much lower than theirs. They had, over time, not let the default stay stagnant, but they continuously improved each season, raising their level of default runs. This applies to business and life. Do you want to eat healthier? Do what others who are healthy do? Their default pantry doesn't contain the unhealthy food that yours and mine may. They put the temptations far away. Their habits are different. They do the boring things well: good sleep, hydration, and exercise. You get the picture. This is how the top 1% live. In talking about the 1%, one author wrote, "Know what you're optimizing for," or in other words, know what being in the top 1% means to you. Because you might think you want what everyone talks about, the money, the status, the speed, but when you take away all of that, maybe you want something else: freedom, time, creative space, or stability. If you pursue the wrong top 1%, you'll burn yourself out and feel empty. So, what does your version of winning or top 1% look like? Once you know that, the path becomes clear. Consider the story of Jeffrey Pfeffer, a professor of organizational behavior at Stanford. Early in his career, he noticed a pattern in academia. Most junior faculty burn out because they chase recognition rather than meaningful work. And instead of focusing on prestige or promotions, he set a goal to understand organizations in a way that he could genuinely help them improve. Over decades, he produced some of the most influential work in organizational behavior, not because he wanted accolades, but because his work mattered to him and to the people he cared about. Another example from sports, but not in the way most people think, consider Katarina Witt, the English-German figure skater who dominated international competitions in the 1980s. She was technically gifted, but what set her apart wasn't skill. It was the stakes she set for herself. Witt came from a system where winning wasn't just about personal achievement. It was tied to national expectations, but she refused to make that the driving force. Instead, she focused on her own pride, artistry, and love of skating. Every training session was grueling, but Witt reframed her work. She wasn't practicing for medals. She was practicing for the joy of mastery and the personal satisfaction of her own performance. When injuries or political pressure threatened to derail her, she continued because her stakes were internal. She wanted to know she had given everything she could, and that sense of personal ownership carried her to Olympic gold. Consider Whitney Wolf Herd, the founder of Bumble, the dating app. After leaving her previous company under difficult circumstances, she could have set her next goal based on revenge or ego or the desire to prove herself to her critics, but Bumble did it differently. Her goal was connected to creating a platform that empowered women to make the first move, something deeply aligned with her values and vision for the future. And that internal connection transformed the way she approached obstacles. Fundraising was grueling, technical issues were relentless, and the market was crowded. Yet her commitment didn't rely on impressing investors or competing with others. It relied on a personal, meaningful stake, a platform she genuinely believed could change people's lives and give women agency. That alignment between goal and personal value helped her persevere, and today Bumble is one of the few female-founded companies to go public with sustained success. So when your goals are tied to stakes that matter to you, like energy and creativity, your endurance is amplified. When your goals are tied to guilt or ego or external validation, your endurance sometimes doesn't last. The top 1% know what they value. It doesn't have to be huge. It can be as simple as the pride you feel when finishing a book, or the freedom you feel from saving money to travel, or the joy of just showing up for your children in a meaningful way. When your goals are tied to stakes that matter, you don't just push through challenges, you engage them differently. You know, one of the best drivers in NASCAR ever was the late Dale Earnhardt Sr. He was definitely in the top 1%. In his final race, he and his son, Dale Jr., and his teammate, Michael Waltrip, were leading the race when a crash occurred on lap 173. After the crash, and before the race started again, Dale radioed his son and Michael to keep in the lead. He wanted them to stay ahead of the field so they wouldn't be subjected to the risk of other drivers. Making mistakes and crashing could often happen that way. Dale told them he would block, meaning he would run in third or fourth place and keep the other cars from getting close. As the laps wound down to the finish, Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Waltrip were battling for the lead. Directly behind them was Dale Sr., who was blocking those behind him from passing him. Driver Sterling Martin kept trying to pass and was making a lot of contact with Earnhardt's car. On the final turn of the race, Earnhardt was perfectly positioned to protect his son and teammate. And in their rush to the front, drivers behind him made contact with Earnhardt, pushing him sideways, and his car slid toward the infield. As Dale corrected, he was hit by Ken Schrader and pushed directly into the wall. As the two cars settled in the infield, Schrader immediately jumped out of his car and ran to check on Earnhardt, who wasn't moving. Dale Sr. would not survive the crash. Not long after, in speaking about his father, Dale Earnhardt Jr., who is also in the top 1% of NASCAR drivers, said the best advice he ever got from his father about racing was this. He said, "My dad took me aside and said, 'Son, if you ever want to win a NASCAR race, you'll have to unhook the boat that you've been towing behind your car in the last 10 races. And you know what Dale Jr. said? He was right. Now, while maybe not the most elegant analogy, I think all of us from time to time are trying to race by pulling a boat behind us. You see, we want all the luxuries we enjoy in life. We want to grow a business, reach our goals, and grow as a person, but we want to keep the comforts that we've been towing along for a while. We don't want to change our habits or behavior. We don't want stress. We don't want to stretch. In many ways, the boat many of us are dragging is our past. We tried before and not succeeded. We've prepared for the race and not finished. We can't seem to let go of the I've tried before and not finished mentality. Perhaps you're trying to lose weight again or to restart your business. And while you're hopeful, there's this underlying drag on your belief. To be in the top 1%, you and I likely need to unhook the boat we've been dragging behind us, or our business, or our goals, or our aspirations, and leave a few things behind and begin the day-to-day work of the future like the 1% do." Helen Adams Keller, an American author, political activist, and lecturer, was the very first person in the United States who was deaf to have ever earned a bachelor's degree. She was born in June of 1880 in Tuscumbia, Alabama. Her father had been a captain in the Confederate Army. Her paternal grandmother was the second cousin to General Robert E. Lee. And one of Helen's ancestors was one of the first teachers of the deaf in Zurich. She was born with the ability to see and hear. However, at the age of 19 months, she contracted meningitis, and this left her both deaf and blind. Annie Sullivan arrived at Keller's house early in Helen's life. It was in March of 1887, and she immediately began trying to teach Helen. She started by trying to spell words in the palm of Helen's hand. The beginning word was doll. Annie would place a doll in Helen's hand and then spell the word on the palm of Helen's other hand. Helen was frustrated because she didn't understand that every object had a uniquely distinct word that would identify it. As a matter of fact, she was so frustrated when Annie gave her a mug and tried to spell that in her hand that Helen picked up the mug and threw it across the room, smashing it against the wall. Helen's miracle breakthrough came just 1 month later when she was experiencing the word water, and she realized that the motions that the teacher was making in the palm of her hand while pouring in the other hand, that it was actually water, that she related this to the words or letters that were being written in her hand. "Suddenly," she said, "I felt a misty consciousness of something long forgotten, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me, and I knew what water, W-A-T-E-R, meant. That meant this wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. The living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. And as we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life." Now, Helen went on to become a world-famous speaker and she met and inspired presidents, leaders, and people of every kind. She was definitely in the top 1%. But there was a turning point when Helen Keller opened her eyes and realized what her teacher was trying to teach her. And it was this miracle that started her on her remarkable journey. Now, I believe that small miracles happen in our lives all the time, but they happen more to those who are trying to live in the top 1%. They get more moments of clarity that always don't arrive on their own. The point is, you and I need to be looking for a miracle. And as we live in the top 1%, we will find them more and more often. So, whatever you're waiting on, whether it's love or children or healing, a job, your business growing, whatever it is, weight loss, feeling healthier, peace, I know this, miracles can and do happen. And I know many of you have been battling an illness or a setback or dealing with a loss in one way or the other. And maybe you're looking for some clarity or a miracle. Please don't give up. Never give up. Keep trying. There is a reason why you are where you are. And here's what I know. If massive good didn't come from grief and loss and even stupid mistakes, God wouldn't allow grief, loss, and stupid mistakes. Start looking for the good. Be open to the miracles that come your way. I believe things are already working together for your good. So as we end today, maybe it's time to begin your climb to the top 1%, the 1% extra effort, the 1% of things you will do that others are unwilling to do to reach the goals that you've set for yourself. And if you do, watch. There in that 1%, you may just find the miracles you've been waiting for are waiting there for you. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to share this podcast with a friend and join us next week for another podcast as we learn to open our eyes to who and what we can become.